Welcome to the Journal.ie's The Explainer, where every week we take a deep dive into a different news story. I'm Sinead O'Carroll, and this week, what's it like being a humanitarian on the ground in Ukraine right now? This episode is supported by the Directorate General for European Civil Protection and Humanitarian Aid Operations, that's DG ECHO for short. It is over a year since the Russian invasion of Ukraine began, and there is no end in sight for the war. We have seen how Ukrainians have had to flee to all corners of the world in search of safety, but there are millions more who have stayed. Many have been displaced within the country after losing their homes and family members, while others try to continue as normal a life as possible amid air raids, energy shortages, and the realities of war. All of these people have needed and continue to need huge amounts of help to survive. To get a view from the ground about how that aid is being organised, we spoke to Claudia Amaral, the head of office for DG ECHO in Kyiv. When I spoke to Claudia on Friday morning, the 10th of March, Russia had launched significant missile strikes on Kyiv the day before. I started by asking her what it had been like in the city that week.
Yes, indeed, we went through a bit of a tough night and early morning yesterday as we had another, you know, massive missile strike across the country, including here in Kyiv, with critical energy infrastructures that were once again hit, and it was perhaps the largest attack of the past couple of months. So indeed, there's been a bit of a rough night with a couple of explosions that we could hear very well here in Kyiv, but the situation has otherwise been relatively calm. We continue to face regular air raid alerts at different hours of the day and the night. Fortunately, not all materialize into missile attacks or result in explosions. So that's obviously very good news. But we have rough days. But of course, other than that, we're all trying to have our normalcy. And it doesn't change the fact that we live in constant awareness and being alert. That at any moment the situation may change, but otherwise we try to go about our routine as normal.
What actually happens when an air raid starts? What do you have to do?
That's a very good question, because it is part of our daily routine, I would say, for a long time. So indeed, when the air raid goes, we have ways of checking how serious the threat is. But an important reflex that we have to have immediately is, you know, make sure that we are ready to move to shelter. We know where the shelters are, and we can track. So we have apps on our phones. We have channels that inform us also on what is expected of the threat. Why did the air raid went off? So we track that. Of course, it does impact the way we work, and it does impact in the sense that, you know, if we go to shelter, often it just derails our work agendas, our plans, our movements for the day. But, you know, safety and security first, and we know what to do in terms of checking, tracking these apps. And if we feel that is more serious, obviously we go to shelter.
Do all people on the ground and normal civilians in Ukraine have access to those kind of apps?
These apps are nationwide and they are available. You download them, and there's two or three key ones, and everybody has them. I mean, you know, literally something very accessible. But your question is also a very important one, because it has to do with the early warning systems and how we get that information. In addition to the apps, the sirens sound across the cities. So there's sirens in different locations. It could be a fire station. It could be, you know, a church. There's different locations for these sirens, and they sound across the city in addition to the apps in our mobile phones. But in rural areas, or in areas where it's not so easy to have these sirens everywhere, often you have local services that go around and warn the people. So I've been in rural areas where I have seen the police cars coming through and alerting the people that the air raid was on.
What has it been like for people living through that over the last few months then?
I mean, at the end of the day, we are all operating in a war context here in Kyiv, like everywhere else in the country. So, of course, the conflict is worse in certain parts of the country, but it's nationwide that we are operating in a war context. So, of course, the situation has been safer and easier here in Kyiv. There's other parts more affected, as I was saying, particularly those closer to the front line, where the conflict is more acute. But, you know, in Kyiv, we're trying to live our normal lives, go to work, take the metro, go to the supermarket, have a coffee in a coffee shop. Services are open. So very much the city tries to be up and running as much as possible. We have faced a lot of power cuts towards the end of last year and early, you know, this year as well. We now coming out of the winter, so it starts to be a little bit better because of the heating demand and the power supply demands for that. But yes, you know, particularly since the 10th of October was a big game changer for us because it's when Kyiv was under attack again and when the massive missile strikes across the nation took place. So it is important for all of us civilians to try and balance from going through our normal routines to living with something that is everything but normal. But we try to make sure that we stay. We deliver humanitarian aid, us, the international community, everyone else that stays and remains as we are needed here. So it's trying to juggle the normalcy with the absurd, I would say.
It's absolutely surreal to even talk to you about it. How long have you yourself been on the ground there?
I've been here since August last year in my new function as head of office for the humanitarian aid department of the European Commission. Before that, I came to Ukraine a few times, but there were more short-term missions and more to support the team. But I've been living here since August.
And it's hard to have a rule book for addressing humanitarian crises, but it is your job. What were the main needs of people when the war broke out?
Yeah, that's an important question. Just to frame it a bit, to say that we were already present here before the February 24th of last year. Since 2014, that humanitarian aid office was responding to the war in Donbas. Of course, at a completely different scale, nothing that is comparable. But since the 24th of February of last year, the needs jumped massively, and the number of people that needed humanitarian support went from, you know, maybe about 3 million in Donbas to an alarming number of 80 million. But to tell you, in the early days, what we needed to do was to scale up the humanitarian aid. So as I was saying to you, we already had partners and presence on the ground. So we increased the funding so that we could, have an intervention that was more widespread, not limited to Donbas, but really go nationwide. So just a couple of very concrete things, to meet the needs of the population on the move, you know, a high number of population on the move, to whom we needed to give hygiene kits, like soap, toothbrush, diapers for children, bottled water, NFI kits, bed linen, blankets. It was cold, let's remember it was February and it was still cold, food in kind, legal aid at border points. This is related to our protection activity as well. And also worth highlighting that the support in kind of the civil protection was also quite important. So massive needs with the people on the move, and we immediately scaled up.
And how do you organize that? How do you make sure you're getting those kind of things to people?
So we have a team on the ground, and we do the needs assessment and follow up closely how the humanitarian needs are evolving. And we coordinate with our partners and with the government in terms of also assessing what those needs are. So we provide the funding so that our partners can respond to those pressing needs. And our intervention is nationwide. So we're not limited to one region or another. We have an intervention that is nationwide. Based on the needs, we go where the needs are, but also multi-sectoral. And this means that we don't look only after, only water or only food or only protection. We go on what is needed. So in this case, it means often that we're doing a response where more than one support is needed. It can be shelter, food, wash, protection, education, cash assistance. So that's why I'm saying that it's multi-sectoral. We prepared for that.
And has it changed over the time? So, you know, we're over a year into the war now. Have the needs of the Ukrainian citizens changed?
Yes, that's a good question because the war is not static. There's shifts in the front line. There's newly accessible areas like Kharkiv, Kherson, that we need to reach with humanitarian support. So yes, the needs are not the same everywhere here in Ukraine. They evolve. It's important to keep in mind that the needs follow people's movements. And in the early days, there was a lot of people on the move, you know, individual families on the move. So a lot of our support was really to meet that need, more limited, fast, quick, that we needed to get out there. As people settle, there's more comprehensive support. In addition to that, we also need to take place that Ukraine is massive as a country, and the needs are not the same if you're in the western part or if you're closer to the front line in the east or in the south. So in the west, where you have the concentration of IDPs, the needs increasingly are more, and as people have settled, the needs are increasingly on jobs, sources of income, on housing, you know, being out of the collective centers, which were these centers that were receiving IDPs. We can call them reception centers for IDPs, but more and more to have their homes. So yeah, so the needs of, in this regard, we've also seen the needs that have changed. But perhaps also important to say that as you get closer to the front line and to the areas where the conflict is more acute, the needs are different. They need everything that is basic, you know, potable, drinkable water, medicine, warm clothes, clothes for children, blankets. So yes, the needs are different. But I would just like also to emphasize, having said that the trends follow people and their movements, and that this changes over time. We see now a big emphasis on shelter solutions and cash assistance over time. That was one of the trends that that we saw. But I think it's important to tell you on also on what has not changed. And what has not changed is that we continue to have a large-scale humanitarian crisis. Recently, the Ukraine Humanitarian Response Plan was released. It was released on the 15th of Feb by the United Nations. And the numbers are staggering. 17.6 million people still are in need of humanitarian aid. So unfortunately, this hasn't changed.
Just to be clear for our listeners, when you say IDPs, you mean internally displaced people, so people who have had to move within the country, so from one area of the country to another area of Ukraine. Isn't that correct?
It's people that have left the place where they originally were, and a lot of them moved to other parts of the country, so they've displaced from point A to point B inside Ukraine, while others have left the country and went abroad.
The numbers are absolutely staggering. Like you said, 17.6 million. How does your organization fit into the humanitarian aid work that's happening out there?
Yes, indeed. The European Commission is working on all four fronts to support Ukraine and its people with emergency assistance since day one. And this includes, of course, humanitarian aid to the value of 630 million euros that we have allocated since the start of the war. So with our humanitarian partners, we have contributed to help close to 16 million people in need.
Tell us about that system of working with partners. What are the types of partners you're working with, and what is the work that they do?
Yes, indeed. So our partners are of three types. It's the UN with all the different UN agencies, and we fund many of them, you know, from UNICEF that deals with the children's mandate, from UNHCR, from WHO on health. So we fund a lot of them. There's also the Red Cross movement and ICRC, a good example that we fund, and the international non-governmental organizations. In turn, these partners that we work with, they have implementing partners of the projects that are local organizations. So important to say that, you know, in the delivery of humanitarian aid, with our support is also the local organizations.
You yourself go on missions and work with the partner organizations and see what is happening on the ground. Can you tell us some of the stories of the people you have seen being impacted by the war?
Yes, no, you're right. We do a lot of missions across the country to monitor, to assess, to coordinate, to talk to the authorities, and to speak directly with the people that are most affected. And the stories are many, and they are incredibly impactful. Perhaps I would like to focus on one that I recently visited a humanitarian hub in the region of Sumy. And in this humanitarian hub, which was basically a private house that since February last year was, you know, donated by the owner to operate as a humanitarian hub. In other words, you could concentrate services, you could concentrate goods that people needed access to, so that people that are displaced from their point of origin could go there and get help. So a very interesting location. And there I met a woman that was initially displaced from Donetsk a few years ago. She had moved to Kharkiv. And now, as a result of the war, she had to leave Kharkiv and she came to Sumy. And she was alone with six children. She had three of her own, plus three of her sister that had just recently passed away. And her husband was, a soldier now, so he was not able to join them. So she came to Sumy with her six children and was in need of support. So through this center, and we help with the funding through our partners to fund these activities, she was supported with multi-purpose cash assistance for some of the most immediate costs that she needed. Non-food food items like the hygiene kits for her and for the kids. Legal aid, because a lot of people have lost documentation, important documentation. And there's also a procedure that is important, which is to document the damages of your house, of your property, when you know that you left behind. So she needed legal aid as well as psychosocial support. And to find out how to continue with the schooling. So she also needed some supporting with that. So this is a concrete case where you see in one family, you see several things coming up on different needs that we need to take into account, particularly when you have children that go to school. But there is something that I would also like to mention to you that is very striking to me when we go across the country and we see these stories. Is that this story also shows you not only the hardship and the suffering these families are going through, what children go through, but it also touches on the mobilization of volunteers. This humanitarian hub came about from a volunteer effort. It's just people that wanted to do their share, show the solidarity amongst themselves. So it was very nice to see the group of volunteers, how they were, you know, united and strengthened and still active a year later. It's the population that is displaced more than one time. In the case of this lady, so years ago she left Donetsk, she went to Kharkiv, and now she had to leave Kharkiv. It is that many of the people supporting with the humanitarian assistance are themselves IDP. So in the course of my discussions in this humanitarian hub, a lot of the people that were helping, they were themselves IDPs, better off, but they know what we're talking about. They are themselves IDPs. And maybe the last point is the trauma that you see. This is still very raw. Even things that have happened months ago, you are speaking with the people and you see the trauma. This is widespread and it will take years to deal with.
Yeah, you mentioned there that a lot of the people who are giving aid are local people themselves. So what's the mix of the partners you work with? Is it mostly local people, or are there people from international places coming in as well to offer help?
Yes, absolutely. There is a mix. So as you said, there are internationals, and as our partners, the ones that we can fund directly, they are part of the international community. But once we start operating here in Ukraine, it's a mix of people. So you have the local professionals of humanitarian aid that are part of these agencies and that are, you know, supporting in the deliveries and are part of the humanitarian group of professionals. Important not to forget that the civil society here is also quite dynamic, quite vibrant and dynamic, very active, and they're present everywhere, part of the common effort as well, and a fundamental role player in the response, and the government themselves, because at the end of the day, we have a government, a strong government in place that tries and does all the efforts they can to deliver the services. But yes, there's a mix here.
When you're talking about meeting those people, what is it like for you on those missions to see people who have had to move from their homes, who have lost everything, who have lost their family?
Of course, some stories are you know, very touching. And it can, there are tough days, of course, because we're talking about people that have lost everything. We're talking about massive suffering. We're talking about trauma that stays. So there's difficult days. And sometimes you walk into certain communities and you see a level of destruction and a level of devastation of all the civilian structure that is difficult to process. But I have to say that you also come out of it with all the smiles, because all the smiles and all the resilience and all the spirit of we're trying to turn this around and make our life better. And we're trying to, you know, we don't have access to services as we used to. Schools are destroyed. The water is not working. The heating is not working. But there's still a resilience of trying to get going, trying to turn it around. Where can they get help? A massive solidarity amongst the population in the communities. So you also come out of that, you know, with this resilience. It's very humbling.
You've also visited the front line. What is the experience of seeing the fighting and seeing the impacts of the fighting there?
Life close to the front line is quite hard. It's incredibly hard. The scenario is really devastation. If I have to put it in one word, is devastation, is large-scale destruction of the civilian infrastructure. It's schools that are not there. They're a shell of it. You know, I always remember walking into elementary schools and seeing the school buses that you can hardly recognize them, given the level of destruction. They you know, completely smashed. And hospitals that are not there, in health clinics that are completely destroyed, shops, supermarkets, banks, you know, all of these services that are essential to everyone's lives that suddenly are not there. And you see people living without electricity, without water, without heating, in very precarious and vulnerable situation. And I have to say that, you know, the routine of these people is spending a lot of hours in the shelters themselves, which is not the environment you would want anyone. And we're talking about elderly people, you're talking about children, and this is not a healthy environment. So yeah, it's always very impactful. But the humanitarian community is working very hard to reach these communities and to deliver the goods that are so needed.
And in your own office, what's the scale of the operation? How many people are working there? How many people are working on the ground?
So, good question. So, there's about 15 of us. We are based here in Kyiv, where we have the main office. We also have colleagues in our sub-office in Dnipro, in the east part of the country, which is for us fantastic because it's closer to some of the most critical areas and where the needs are the highest. And we also have an antenna in Lviv. So, there's about 15 of us. That live here. We're based here. This is where we are. Of course, in addition to the humanitarian aid office, we also have other EU colleagues from the delegation. But in terms of the humanitarian office, about 15 of us. And those of us that are specifically on the operational side, I mean, we're not always at our desk. Very much our job is to be out there visiting the communities, coordinating, assessing, liaising, monitoring, and above all, to have a direct contact with the people in need of our assistance.
What are the biggest challenges then that you as a team face in actually getting the help to people?
Well, the challenges that we face is the challenges that, you know, the humanitarian community faces in general, which is the scale and intensity of the crisis that is so overwhelming. And it is challenging in itself because Ukraine is a large country. So, I mean, we're talking really about scale here as well. And the situation is not the same everywhere. So this means that as humanitarians, we need to be very flexible, very agile, because the war is not static and the needs are not the same everywhere. But the needs are there and we still need to meet them. So flexibility, agility, being able to constantly adapt to ensure that we are delivering where it's most needed and to who needs it the most. And of course, access to the population is another big challenge. In other words, there's areas where the conflict is very active. And there's areas where it's very difficult for us for security and safety reasons to reach. And that is always a concern. And we're always on the lookout to see if there's an opportunity to get there.
It is so unreal just to be talking for listeners, just to get a vision. You're like, you're in an office, there's a map behind you, it looks completely normal, whereas it's the absolute opposite of that for your team and for you. What is your time frame for the team to stay in Ukraine?
Yes, for now we don't have a time frame because we'll stay as long as necessary. I mean, that has been a very clear message from the EU, and our job is far from being done. As I was saying earlier, I mean, the numbers are staggering, and we still, you know, with almost 18 million people in need of humanitarian assistance, and we still have over 5.3 million of people that are internally displaced, not to mention a number of 5+ million people as well that are returning. And there's challenges with the return as well. And they're returning either from inside Ukraine, trying to go back to other regions of the country or to their point of origin where they used to live before to check on their houses and everything, or people that are returning from abroad. So the challenges and the needs are still very prevalent. And access to healthcare, to water, to electricity, these are all services that are not up and running as we would like them to. So no time frame on this one. We need it. We're here. We'll continue.
And what happens if there is a big change in what's happening within the war itself, like if Russia advances even more or the fighting becomes even more intense in areas where it's not currently as intense?
Yeah, that's an important point from a humanitarian point of view. If we were up against such a scenario, that would mean more displacement of people, obviously, because they would be leaving those areas, in search for other places that would be safer and secure. And as well, lack of access for us to deliver humanitarian assistance. So these would be massive concerns for us, is more influx of people having to leave and move elsewhere, lack of access for us to deliver humanitarian aid. That would be of concern, obviously.
You talked earlier about the needs of the people in Ukraine evolving over time. What do you think will be the longer term needs there?
The answer to that question, in fact, I'm not sure I have it, because at the end of the day, it will depend for how long the war goes. I mean, at the end of the day, we need, we need the war to stop in order for us to see that humanitarian needs decrease. But so there's a lot of unknowns here. But we may still be faced with life-saving needs closer to the front line and the battleground areas. This means that the most basic things are needed, you know, drinkable water, medicines, health services, all of these very basic multi-sectoral things that we would have to make sure that we reach to the people who are undergoing, the toughness of being closer to the front line or combat areas. But of course, there's the other side of people that have settled in, and we need to focus more the attention and the needs to self-reliance. The jobs, home, school for the kids to go to. So it's important that we continue to work on these linkages that go from the humanitarian to longer term perspectives, what we sometimes call in this line, the nexus, is linking up a humanitarian response with a longer term perspective, because at some point we will not be the right mechanism for that response. And in this regard, we already have some processes in place, liaising with development donors, with the Ministry of Social Protection for the cash assistance and the longer-term integration with social protection schemes.
As you said, hopefully the war will end so that work can start. What type of impact is this having on you personally, and how do you manage it, Claudia?
No matter how experienced we are, we are, of course, always impacted by what is happening, and we go through days where we are confronted with tough scenarios, tough stories, things that are a little bit difficult to process and to digest like anyone else. I mean, in this case here, the humanitarian community is not different from others. I mean, we go through the air raids, we have to go to shelter, we hear the explosions, and when they are, taking place not too far away from us. And this, I can safely tell you that it's not a pleasant experience. And even yesterday, in one of the strong and loud explosions here in Kyiv, you feel, you know, sometimes the rocking of the house, and it's not a pleasant experience. Of course, and I faced water and electricity cuts like so many other people have faced, but all knowing that there's so many more enduring a hardship much worse than us here, that you know, in Kyiv. But I am a mother of a 10-year-old, and I am a daughter of a 77-year-old lady. So of course it is tough when I go through the communities and I see children the age of my daughter that cannot go to school, or I see people the age of my mother that are being put into question on the place they've lived all their lives. That's all they know. That's where they want to stay. That's where they have their memories. And suddenly that is put into question. So of course, this is difficult. But I have to say that I have never seen something so rewarding at the same time. Because we know that we are part of the alleviation of this suffering with the humanitarian assistance that is provided. We're part of that, and that makes me proud. And I really take away lessons of resilience, lessons of solidarity, and lessons of hope. And that we cannot take away from the Ukrainians, but you can't take that away from me as well. I feel, I feel that this makes a difference, that we're helping, and I bring those smiles back with me and that eagerness to keep going.
I think ending on that hopeful note, I think, makes sense. Claudia, thank you so much for talking to us on The Explainer, and best of luck with everything you are doing out there. And hopefully, as you said, the war will come to an end soon so that longer term work can start.
It's been my pleasure. Thanks to you as well.
Thank you for listening to The Explainer, and a big thank you to Claudia for joining us. This episode of The Explainer was brought to you by producers Nikki Ryan and Aoife Barry. It was supported by DG Echo. If you enjoyed this episode, please consider supporting us so we can continue to make more just like this one. There's a couple of things you can do. Head to thejournal.ie/contribute to become a monthly subscriber or make a one-off donation. You can also leave us a review and rating wherever you listen to your podcasts. It's a really great way to make sure other people can discover it, listen, and love it as well. Thank you, and catch you next time.